Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Bratfeld, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning. Please have a seat. I'm just going to take a minute to set up here. Welcome to Minnesota Court of Appeals. Oops. Get my password in. Okay. Welcome. Today is Thursday, February 8th, and the first case on our calendar, let me just ask for the pronunciation of Mr. Oyugi's name, please.
Oyugi.
Ingram Oyugi. Great, thank you. Okay, the first case on our calendar this morning is A23-1702 in the matter of the civil commitment of Ingram Oyugi. Counsel, let me make sure I also, you will be introducing yourselves. Each of you, as you know, has 15 minutes for your principal argument, and then counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. When you start your arguments, I ask that you state your name and the party for the record, and if there's any particular way in which anyone wants to be referred to by us, let us know then. The center podium toggles up and down with a toggle switch, and so take a second, get set up, and then counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you can begin. It's to your right, I think, or in the center? In the center, there's a toggle switch.
Oh, yeah, there it is. Yeah. I was only here a couple months ago. I should remember this.
That's all right.
Okay. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Tom Hagler. I represent the appellant, Mr. Oyugi. And I think the main issue here is that there was no clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Oyugi engaged in an overt act capable of causing serious physical harm. And that's for two reasons. First is that no reliable evidence that bear pepper spray causes blindness or irreversible eye damage was entered into the record. And two, there's no clear evidence that Mr. Oyugi sprayed the pepper spray directly into someone's eyes at close range. And to the first point, there's no evidence of a pepper spray's blinding capability on the record. The petitioner makes these assertions with no facts to support them and asks the court just to take their word for it that pepper spray blinds people. Where are the statistics? Where is the medical, the relevant medical or scientific evidence that on the record? It's not there.
So can you tell me, I think if we step back and look at the standard, that the argument you're making goes to whether it is serious physical harm? What's the standard that's at issue? And then my follow-up question is,
yes.
Why are you asserting, I think, that it would have to cause blindness or would have to do that? Okay.
Okay, Your Honor, the standard is a person engaged in an overt act causing or attempting to cause serious physical harm to another. And the serious standard is the plain meaning of serious. The common understanding of serious does not allow but it doesn't mean just any affront to be labeled as serious. The court in Kottke, in the matter of Kottke, suggests that only extreme acts of violence satisfy the statutory requirement of serious physical harm.
But you would agree that spraying someone with, was it bear mace? And I think what was in Kottke was like using a closed fist against a security guard. I mean, those are different, there's a different magnitude. Would you agree?
To some extent, but not, I think because the facts are not in the record. Okay, my point is that the petitioner in her in their closing statements and in their brief, they refer to well, luckily this person wasn't blinded, or this could cause irreversible eye damage. And they rely on a product liability warning label. But, you know, warning labels warn against using a product in the wrong way. There's no evidence that this spray was used in any manner other than its intended use here, which is to spray a target at some distance. And my second point is there's no clear evidence that Mr. Oyugi sprayed the pepper spray directly point blank into somebody's eye. And that's what would cause an injury. That's what the label refers to, is spraying it directly on the eyeball at point blank range. And it's actually the pressure of the product. It's not the chemical. The chemical is a pepper.
But does it matter in thinking through these things, as you obviously have, that this criteria is also not just causing or attempting to cause? So maybe you could be found to attempting to cause serious physical harm, even if you didn't spray it directly into. Wouldn't that be another way to look at this?
The the back to the Kottke case. I think they said that when a person commits an assault yet has neither inflicted nor intended to inflict serious physical harm as contemplated by the statute, the person's actions are more appropriately defined as mentally ill. And I think under the Kottke standard, this case is a mentally ill case, or maybe mentally ill and harm at most. And that the standard for mentally ill and harm is substantial likelihood of physical harm to self or others demonstrated by a recent attempt or threat to physically harm self or others. I think this, because there is not clear and convincing evidence, and as far as spraying it into someone's eyes, the petitioner repeatedly tried to put those words in the witness's mouth. And clearly, they've obviously sought to compare this case to the Tempel matter, where that person used a tear gas, sprayed it directly in someone's eyes at point-blank range, and threatened to kill them, and they had a gun. So that case is distinguishable here from the facts. It's also, Tempel is also a non-published, non-presidential case. But the witness never said that they were sprayed in the eyes. Those words were the petitioner's counsel's words, and it's not in the police reports either.
So in terms of what the district court found for Syria, I mean, apart from the arguments made that you're referring to, the district court, I have a question for you. I was just trying to find it. I'm sorry, I don't know. Did the district court rely on the manufacturer's label? I see in finding 37 in the district court's order, it's at page 15. The court says that officers found the alleged victims crawling in pain on the driveway. It was the alleged victim's eyes were closed, difficult to open, and their faces were red. And then somewhere, I believe also the court refers to, maybe not there, but elsewhere, the victim's testimony that they were in excruciating pain. Is that what the word was, I believe? So why is that not enough for serious physical harm?
Well, because I think for it to be serious, it shouldn't be just a temporary irritation. The mother was still able to see and dial 911 and has, you know, no lasting effects of the irritation. The Kottke case, I mean, look at the examples they give. And Jarvis V. Levine shot and killed his sister. In the Lufsky case, dragged his father by an electrical cord around the neck. Mokalanik stabbed the wife of a man she delusionally believed to be her lover. And DeMars V. State murdered a sleeping mother. And there are other cases, like the next year, the Jasmer case, that case is contemplating actions like driving 100 miles an hour into a crowd of people or shooting a shotgun at another person. So I think besides the problems with the findings here, which I believe are clearly erroneous, and that they did admit unreliable hearsay. And then, you know, instead of, you know, rejecting the unreliable hearsay, the court didn't even express its basis for deeming the apparently unreliable evidence reliable. And that would be under the Blaylock case, which is another unreported case from 2009. And then there are other evidentiary issues too. The doctor's evidence was unreliable too. Both doctors said that they never, one doctor, Dr. Jorgensen, said she never met with him. Her opinion was based solely on police reports, correctional officers, jail records, and criminal complaints. The other doctor, McKenna, her opinion, largely based on records other than and the other evaluator's opinion, one of which was based solely on records without ever meeting him. And her direct interaction amounted with less than 10 minutes. And she said it didn't amount to much. He was polite and that he was not violent in jail. So I think you add that to the fact that there's expert evidence was improperly admitted. The commitment court is supposed to follow the rules of evidence, yet unfounded expert testimony was admitted when they asked these two psychologists about, you know, hypothetical physical injuries, and, you know, they gave their opinions, even though they're not qualified experts on that subject, on what, you know, what the distance of bear spray is, or pepper spray is serious. You know, I think, and if you look at the warning labels and what the government makes the warning label say, it's not intended to be used to spray directly on the eyeball at point blank range, because it's the same reason you wouldn't poke your eye in, your finger in your eye. So it's not that it's the chemical, it's just a pepper spray. It's an organic chemical that people put on food actually in some circumstances. But for public policy reasons, also suggest that this is not the type of assault that warrants indefinite or indeterminate commitment, because the pepper spray is legal to purchase, it's legal to possess, and in certain circumstances, it's legal to use. And the legislature has made the unlawful use of this irritant a misdemeanor assault.
Counsel, you haven't talked about the use of the taser. Are you going to do that?
Excuse me, Your Honor. The use of the taser, I also would not consider that a seriously dangerous act. For one thing, it didn't connect, or one of the prongs may have connected.
That goes back to Judge Jessen's question. The statutory standard is about even an attempt to seriously harm another.
Well, I guess then the question is, are these non-lethal products and devices that are legally available in Minnesota, are they really causing...
Guns are legally available in Minnesota. I don't think you're going to get very far with that argument.
I would say that the taser it bounced off the officer's vest. I don't think it was a serious attempt to hurt anyone.
And again, I understand that, you know, these cases are difficult. There was a lot of evidence submitted to the court. You have some very specific arguments and challenges about the types of evidence. But nonetheless, you know, we are going to use our standard of review to examine the district court's analysis. And it seems to me that there is certainly these acts that were committed that support the district court's decision.
So. Your Honor, I would go back to the other examples that the courts before us have given, and
other
they
case
are
law.
Seriously okay. violent acts, and these don't rise to that level. The MIND statute just did not contemplate indefinite commitment for this kind of simple assault. And, you know, I, my, There's also another case unpublished, the in re civil commitment of Ingram from 2002 that states a committee should have an extensive violent history of violent behavior. I don't think that exists here. I mean, he's got a few limited incidents of simple assault that didn't really rise to any serious physical injury. And I think a less restrictive alternative does exist. And even Dr. Jorgensen agreed that the mental health system here, the provisional discharge plan did not work for him. And the treatment team never really afforded Mr. Oyugi the opportunity to stay at an intensive residential treatment center or services facility, an ERTS facility.
So, counsel, I was going to ask you about the less restrictive alternative argument, which relates to, I mean, I think at the last time, at least it's reflected in the record, as far as I could see, your client was at the Hennepin County Jail. Is he at the forensic facility in St. Peter?
I was just notified yesterday that he did get there. He has been admitted in the last couple of days.
And because I see what you were saying about AMRTC, that would certainly be better than being in the jail.
Yeah, and I think, but at St. Peter, we know a couple weeks ago a patient was murdered there, and people are assaulted all the time there. It's a dangerous place. They've never given him the chance for a sort of an intermediate facility, and I think the burden created by Minnesota's failure to have these appropriate intermediate facilities shouldn't fall on the person with the disability. And I think this is an unjustified institutional isolation of a person with a disability under the Olmstead case, the Supreme Court case from 1999. Thank you.
Great. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And counsel for the respondent. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Ann Sarah Elasky. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney on behalf of Hennepin County. Your Honors, Mr. Ingram Oyugi is a person who poses a risk of harm due to mental illness and he is dangerous to the public as defined in Minnesota Statute 253B.02 Subdivision 17. And over the course of the 2 days of hearings between the initial commitment as well as the indeterminate commitment, the court received thousands of pages of exhibits. They heard testimony from appellant's mother, at both hearings, as well as appellant at the first hearing, and two different court-appointed psychologists. And the court took all of that into consideration when it determined that commitment as mentally ill and dangerous to the Minnesota Security Hospital, or the Forensic Mental Health Program, is the least restrictive and appropriate disposition for the case. So in this case, appellant's not disputing that he's mentally ill. It's the overt act, and as he discussed the least restrictive alternative. So let's talk about first what the statute requires. So mental illness, and then that there is a clear danger to the safety of others as demonstrated by the facts that the person has engaged in an overt act causing or attempting to cause serious physical harm to another. And that there's a substantial likelihood that the person will engage in the acts capable of inflicting serious harm. So there's the past piece of the overt act and the future piece of the future likelihood of harm. So in this case, appellant discusses the overt act and states that Mr. Oyugi's his actions were more similar to Kotke. And in the Kotke case, as was discussed, it's more of kind of an unintentional just lashing out when he was being arrested being detained by a security guard.
Is it unintentional? Didn't he come back and push the officer down?
He did,
I don't remember which one. There were two, were both
there were
the
two
officers.
Incidents.
Right, there was the officer and then also the
security guard.
Person.
Right,
yeah.
And in Kotke, it was more kind of just this lashing out. There of him trying to kind of get away from the security in one case, in one instance, as well as to kind of just get out of the physical hold. Versus in this case where the overt acts of, let's talk about the taser first, we'll go in reverse order, the later April date, murder and mayhem does not have to occur, the Carroll case says, that it's the action that is, it's not the act, it's not what happens, not the result, it's the actual action of it and whether that action can cause serious harm. Tasing someone can cause someone serious harm. And the fact that the officer was wearing their vest and it didn't connect with that to that officer, it's lucky and it's good that that officer was properly dressed. However, that doesn't negate the actions that were that happened on that day.
So, counsel, I mean, I understand your quote, you know, murder and mayhem doesn't have to occur, but wouldn't you agree that the overt act here is not as extreme as we typically see looking at the MIND case law going back, you know, several decades?
I wouldn't say it's definitely not murder. So that would definitely be an extreme that we have committed people for mentally ill and dangerous commitments. However, the incident with the police, but even more so the incident with his mother and sister. And
the incident in 2020?
I'm talking about specifically the April of 2023 incidents of spraying his mother and his sister. And they were sprayed in the face. They were sprayed with bear spray. And whether or not it's directly in the eye for the pressure, it's still a chemical irritant that is used to deter aggressive bears. And that's why it's on the market. It is not to use against a person. And as police described in the police reports, they are on their hands and knees, and she did testify that she was in excruciating pain from the chemical irritant that she and her daughter received to the face. They had to seek medical attention to get their face cleared. So even though, no, there's not murder in this case, there is still enough danger and the escalation of his violence over the course, because the court does look at the history of the acts of the person prior to a commitment and his trajectory from 2019 and the lack of insight into his need for treatment as well as his needs for medication, his need to stabilize, that is what the court looked at, and the history of violence, the threats against the sister.
If you don't mind, it seems to me like you shifted over now and are talking about this substantial likelihood that this type of harm will occur again, which is fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, I appreciate that's an issue. But just going back, if I could, to the case law, you know, I hear you as arguing this is not like Kottke, and let's just accept that for a moment. But what is it like? So what case is this type
of
act like?
Take, for example, Jasmer. Jasmer was a case where he was shooting a shotgun, and it happened to be in the direction of a child. I'm forgetting how old the child was, but I know it was an adolescent. And it didn't hit the adolescent, but the fact that he was in his yard shooting a shotgun towards the child, who was not injured, but that action of doing it, that constituted serious harm because there was an attempt, even though he wasn't intentionally trying to shoot and kill the child, or there wasn't evidence of it.
And I would agree with you that the intent, you know, element is not at least obviously embraced in the statute. So I track that. What I'm struggling with is, by giving that example, you know, if it seems to me to support appellant's argument that the type of harm, you know, the serious harm would be of a greater magnitude than what we saw here if, you know, a missed shotgun aim is the next similar type of example that you come to. Because obviously if the shotgun head, if the person in Jasmer head aimed the shotgun hit the child, I mean, those are serious physical injuries, I don't see that evidence with regard to the bear mace spray.
So,
maybe I'm missing it.
So appellant stated that bear mace, if sprayed in directly in somebody's eye, could cause blindness. And the literature that was presented at the trial court did state that. So just because appellant was not directly in front of the person and his mother
so
and his sister.
You do rely on the possible causing of blindness.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. The fact that they could have had more serious injuries, we're lucky that they didn't, but that doesn't have to occur. It is the action of him using that chemical irritant in their faces is serious.
When I'm looking at the district court's order, did the district court rely on that information from the manufacturer?
The district court, the district court's order, it doesn't specify that it was that particular evidence. The district court more generally says that they relied on the evidence as a whole.
Okay, and didn't talk about blindness, did it, the district court?
The district court order did not specifically state that could be a possible outcome, blindness. But they
What I'm wondering is the chemical irritant is meant to irritate. I think that's how it's used, right? I mean, it's meant to actually bother the people who encounter it, and that's how it suppresses whatever they're up to. And so I think the argument is using it and not having read or looked at right now the manufacturer's information, what counsel for appellant said is I think that the harm that the blindness is caused by the pressure as opposed to the nature of the irritant itself. I guess I don't know. We don't know. We know it hit him in the face. It hurt a lot, which might not be unusual for the normal use of a chemical irritant to keep someone away from you.
But the bear mace is different than the mace someone might carry to protect themselves in a situation. Bear mace is specifically for bears, aggressive bears. And
that's what the manufacturer's information went to?
Correct. That talks about the serious, don't spray it on people. If you do, you have to seek attention right away. Because it is the chemical irritant, absolutely, if it gets in your eye, can cause serious harm to your eyes. So
is the bear mace used in both mace incidents? Is that what was used with the police as well? Do we know?
I am not positive about that, Your Honor.
Okay.
I just know that from the police reports that an aerosol was sprayed up the stairwell towards the police, but the police were wearing protective gear, masks, because they had information that he had was the other incident where he did have bear mace. So regarding the overt act, I believe that the overt act is sufficient and that the case law that states that it's not necessary that the person intends to or succeeds in causing serious physical harm, but the statute focuses on the dangerous nature of the act and not whether the victim actually suffers serious physical harm. So I contend that the dangerous nature of the act of spraying someone in the face with bear mace is sufficient for an overt act, as well as the tasering of the police officers. So now in terms of, I just like to, since I only have a couple more minutes, talk about the less restrictive alternative issue. And Mr. Oyugi, it is true that he did not go to the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. However, AMRTC is a hospital. It is the largest psychiatric hospital that Minnesota has, and it is specifically designed for very acute psychotic people to be stabilized there. The average stay is approximately 100 days because it is a stabilization hospital. It is not a placement where someone goes to gain insight into their mental illness, to receive therapy and treatment, to have that longer-term stabilization so that they can be in society, so they can be provisionally discharged and get back into society with having, FMHP, Forensic Mental Health Program, they changed the name from the Minnesota Security Hospital because it is not a hospital setting. It is more of a program that is to help on a long-term basis people who are dangerous, but to help them with a relapse prevention plan, with medication, insight into the need for medications, and it's a longer-term placement for people who are dangerous. So the fact that he didn't go to AMRTC was because he was stabilized in hospitals, HCMC. I believe he went to North Memorial at some point, but he was stabilized in those hospitals, so he didn't need AMRTC to get medication stabilization. So that is not, AMRTC is not equivalent to or necessarily a less restrictive of FMHP in terms of being able to get that long-term stabilization with and gaining insight into the need for mental illness treatment. And then, since I'm also limited on time, I wanted to discuss in terms of the appellant's admission of hearsay evidence in the Williams case and its progeny. Williams discusses the statute as well as the rule, which states that all relevant, reliable evidence, including but not limited to respondents' medical records, should be admitted without requiring foundational witnesses. So in terms of the court did not err in relying upon all of the information that it deemed to be relevant. There were witnesses who testified. The court specifically stated in its order that it found the doctor's testimony to be credible. They found appellant's mother to be sincere, but yet relied more on the doctor's testimony, as well as they did not find Mr. Oyugi, when he testified, to be a sincere or credible witness, a historian, an accurate historian. So in terms of this particular case, the district court found that there was sufficient evidence to commit the respondent based on his entire history, as well as those overt acts that occurred in April of 2023, and that there is not clear error, I believe, in this case to reverse the district court's order. So respondent is asking that this panel uphold the district court order and affirm its decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Excuse me, counsel for appellant. You have 5 minutes.
Thank you. In response to that, I would just say it's not clear at all that Mr. Oyugi presents a danger and a continuing danger. I think, yes, murder and mayhem did not occur, but nor could it have. I think tasing someone, just doesn't pose a risk of serious injury. Using pepper spray the way it's intended also does not pose a risk of serious injury. But also, those things are not on the record. Where is the evidence that a taser could kill somebody on the record in this case? That was never entered. And also the pepper spray, yes, it's marketed as a bear deterrent. However, if you look at their label and their website, it talks about spraying an attacker in the face. So it's not clear that it's just for bears. And it is also the same substance that is in regular pepper spray. Again, there's no evidence of the blindness capability of pepper spray on the record. No statistics, no scientific evidence was introduced to back that up. The incident where Mr. Oyugi allegedly sprayed some substance up the stairs, I would say also not creating a risk of serious harm because the police weren't even sprayed. It didn't come into contact with them. He was much too far away. And if the closest case that the petitioner has is the Jasmer, where the guy's shooting a shotgun, I think we're very far apart. And that case is completely different. At the FMHP, the average stay there is 7 years. I think, if Mr. Oyugi was convicted of a misdemeanor, he'd be on probation and he'd be out back at home already. But, you know, he's a recent college graduate. I think 7 years is going to just completely derail his life, and I think it's not warranted in this case. Thank you.
Thank you both. thank you for your briefing. Thank you for your arguments. Case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. Thank you.